Now we're going to take a little time for some questions and answers. And then because we haven't had a chance to eat today, we're going to do that. That's our plan. Is that a good plan? There's a little coming and going over the course of our time. And we're slow learners. I'm talking particularly about me. You can include yourself in that if you would like. The purpose of Boost, are you getting tired of hearing me say this? Is to bring you fellowship and encouragement and training and networking. And the reason that's important is because we need it. Right? And my purpose is to try to bring you primarily encouragement over these couple of days. We get into incredible anxiety around the pressures that we face in our work. And we can get knocked off stride because of that anxiety. We can underperform magnificently because of that anxiety. And it is Satan's great delight to confuse and distract and to worry, to get you looking back over your shoulder at the scoreboard when you ought to be running for the end zone. It's Satan's great delight to do that. And this evening we're going to be talking about profit because we want it. You want your life to profit. Can I hear an amen?
Amen?
You want your life to profit. You want your business to profit. We need profit. We need result. We want it to count. And it is a particular area of anxiety for us that can get us tangled up in our own feet, causing us to pay attention to the wrong things, the things that actually don't produce profit. And this word profit is a very big word. I'm all for it. But I want to hear some answers. What are you doing that results in profit? Shout. Speak loudly.
Find a need in the community first.
Find a need in the community first. Who said that? Thank you. Find a need in the community first. Produce as much as you can with the least amount of input.
Buy low, sell high.
Buy low, sell high. I wasn't looking. Was that you, Steve? How do you produce profit?
By being more competent than my competition.
By being more competent than your competition.
Do an excellent
job. Do an excellent job.
Build relationships.
Grow people.
Scare them into needing it.
And then jack the price.
Passion.
Know your margins. Is that what you said? Which of these answers is wrong? I haven't heard, well, scare them into needing it.
Is that the chocolate guy?
I didn't see who said that. Now I did. Well, all of those answers are true. All of those answers are right in the sense that all of those answers speak to the disciplines that we need to put around our behaviors when we're creating value. But fundamentally, the root of profit, which all of your answers contribute to as disciplines, added to the root of profit, is bringing value to a customer who values it. That's the root of profit, bringing value. You can say serving something that there is a readiness to value because you serve it, bringing value to somebody who values it. You've got to bring value. You've got to add value. You've got to create, innovate, design, scheme, fix, solve, improve, deliver, build something that is valued. If you create, resolve, fix, and deliver something that is not valued, you have a hobby. But you're not creating profit. I think of profit in a complete sense from what shows up between the buy low and the sell high, and what profits, truly profits, what truly profits the world. And I am convinced, I said this to you earlier today, that the deeper we get in thinking about what great business is, I don't mean what activities are that can derive cash. We can derive cash without profiting. We also call that stealing. We can get cash into our bank account without bringing any value to the world. That's thievery. It's done every day legally. In the deepest sense, creating true value for the world, that is, bringing something into the world that is valued because it's valuable, because there is somebody who values that we do that, is contributing to the advancement of God's kingdom. And we have to get these two vector points to come together in our brain so that we can become better and better leaders. I don't recommend the business model that scrapes profits off a fantasy. You can get cash into your account, but you can't keep that up forever. Because sooner or later, the fact that that value exchange isn't there is going to become clear. And so we want to build true, lasting value. We want to bring good to the world. We want to do things that cause goodness to occur. And whenever we do, we profit. We will, precisely because what we're doing is profitable. Good business is one of the most moral things on earth. Value creation is a deeply moral work. And as we bring value to a customer, and that customer values it back, we're pleasing the Lord. And I want us to unpack this a little bit, and I want us to get our eyeballs onto the deep levers of profit, given the fact that our Lord, at the end of the day, is the vine dresser. And maybe we'll just read that passage right now. Thank you, Joe, for your Bible. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. John 15. He cuts off every branch in me. This sounds nice. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. I said earlier today, suffering is in the soup. There's cutting on both sides of this, isn't there? Cuts off every branch that does not bear fruit, and those that do bear fruit, he prunes. Yay. Somebody said at dinner, kind of makes me not want to be a Christian. Except the cutting happens if you're not. That was a facetious comment at dinner. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. We're talking about being profitable. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be given you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. I listened to that text as a boy rather frequently in the Mennonite Church in Lancaster Conference where I grew up. Bearing fruit, branches getting cut off, stuff getting burned. And I didn't like it. It made me anxious. It made me anxious around the issue of profit. Would I be fruitful? Or would I get burned? That's the way I calculated it. So I got a question for you. There's a commandment in that passage that I just read. What is it?
Bear fruit.
Abide. Got two answers. One of them's right. Abide. I spent my first 25 years understanding that the commandment was to bear fruit. I don't know if you're going to be comfortable or not with what I'm about to say to you. We are not commanded to bear fruit. Anybody want to leave the room now? It isn't there. I thought it was there. No fruit, we get cut off and burned. Sounds to me like I better bear fruit. The commandment is to abide. Who takes responsibility for the fruit bearing? He does. Who else wants to leave the room now? He takes responsibility for the fruit bearing. Our commandment is to abide in him. Read that passage as many times as you want. There is a consequence for not bearing fruit in the passage. You didn't miss it. But the commandment is to abide. Now, why is that? He says, without me, you can do nothing. Interestingly, Jesus himself said, I do nothing on my own. Even Jesus. I only do what I see the Father doing, he said. Did you ever watch the branches of an apple tree straining to pop out an apple? I'm going to get an apple. The most natural thing in the world for the branch of an apple tree when it is healthily attached to the trunk and the roots is to bear fruit. The branch is not responsible for the apple. The branch has to be connected and the fruit bearing comes through. How you doing? We're talking about fruit this evening. And I began by telling you that there is a distinctive capability that God placed in you because God designed you purposefully that allows you to go out into the world being who God made you to be. Yes, working very hard. Yes, learning about your margins. Yes, understanding what the market will bear. All of that. Those are the disciplines that are absolutely necessary around the activity that brings profit. so we can get better and better and better and better at what we do. But fundamentally, that which makes it possible for you to be about the creation of profit in the world has to do with your faithful abiding as the creature you are and your faithful living out as the creation you are, all that God put in you. He takes responsibility for your fruitfulness. I don't know how much anxiety that produces in you, you who, like me, want to do it yourself. I'm not going to ask for testimonies, but this is a significant issue in our lives. We did a couple of things. I want to review them, and my purpose is to be an encouragement to you. I want you to step up and in to who you are in Christ. I want you to get clearer about this enterprise that you're at the helm of. I want you to get clearer about this congregation you're leading. I want you to become joyfully engaged in what God has placed in you so that God can work up and out of you all that He worked down and into you. And I want you to stop while you're running full tilt down the field. You're glancing over the shoulder to see what the score is. I want us to get past the performance anxiety of our enterprise and get in to the obedient work of abiding in Him. We talked about three things. Number one, I heard all of your brief descriptions of the church or business or ministry, the nonprofit you lead. Every single one of you that stands at the helm of an organization or serves an organization serves in a distinctive organization in terms of the vision you hold. You have an answer to the why question that is the one God put in you. Distinctive as a value creation opportunity in the marketplace. Number two, you have a mission. You have a what. Yes, you have a why. You have a what that is unique. Gave you some examples of different what's. What does Cleveland Clinic do, I asked you. What did Domino's Pizza do, I asked you. Yes, question, comment? Steve? Who? Somebody said something? I'm hearing things. Oh, good. Thank you. So there's a distinctive what. There's a certain way that you move. There's a certain way that you see because of the way God made you. There's a certain way that you move toward what you see. Guy next to you isn't going to move that way. And there's a certain way in which you behave given your values. And what I want us to understand is in God's universe, it's not a finite amount of resources that you're competing for. The more you take on the reality of the uniqueness of the creature that you are, the uniqueness of the enterprise, that which your church can do that the church down the street cannot, because God wants your church to be able to touch certain things that the other church can't, the more you take that on. Stop staring at your neighbor, looking over the cubicle wall, copying their homework. The more you move into the identity and the calling that you have, the harder and the harder and the harder it is for you to be competed with. One of a kind. We want to get ourselves further and further away from the comparables. My friend Kent McElhattan founded Industrial Scientific 30 years ago. Mine Safety had a division. They were a $9-10 billion company, and they had a loser of a division that manufactured gas detection equipment. And Kent was tired of working for other people, and so he bought from Mine Safety their gas detection business, which they were glad to get rid of because it was just a stinker to them. And Kent had a vision. He had a distinctive way of seeing, and he had a passion. He had a passion about this, and he said, I have a vision that we can eliminate death on the job. The vision statement for Industrial Scientific is, the people of Industrial Scientific are dedicated to eliminating death on the job in this century. Now, that's their updated vision statement. They had a vision statement in the last century that was about growing their people. They've become bolder. They were last place in the gas detection business. That vision created a point of focus beyond gas detection manufacturing to a standard of excellence. That vision for eliminating death became a rallying cry that the competitors couldn't match. The competitors had other things they were trying to get done, but they didn't have a rallying cry around excellence and around passion. That passion was brought into daily storytelling about people who had died at work and the fact that that's unacceptable. Kent goes through his plants and asks his people to imagine that their mom, their dad, their sister, their brother is wearing this implement that they're building. And he says to them, would you be okay with that thing you're building? Protecting your dad if he worked in a mine. Because if you're not okay with it, I'm not shipping it. He had a vision in the middle of a crowded field of gas detection manufacturers to eliminate death at work. Are you with me? That vision was powerful. It was personal. It created a reason to care. And they grew and they grew and they grew and they became a threat in the marketplace. And at a certain point, 3M bought, they also had a gas detection division. 3M bought two of Kent's competitors, cobbled them together in a big gas detection interest in order to bury Industrial Scientific, and completely screwed it up and took all three companies out of business. Because they were thinking about margins and cost savings and lots of things that matter as secondary disciplines to that which creates value. Don't just hear what I said as worrying about margins and disciplines and lean as not important. It is secondary. It isn't what creates value. It's what brings discipline to that which creates value. What creates value is bringing value to the world. Kent was after, we should not allow people to go to work and die. You know, in the last 100 years, workplace death worldwide has dropped by 90%. Did you know that? In the last 100 years, workplace death has dropped by 90%. And if Kent were here, he would say, what kind of comfort is that if it was your husband that got killed? He brings a vision. He brings a passion. That brought a discipline. That brought a focus. He kept his eye on the ball. He kept his eye in the playing field. He's not looking over his shoulder wondering what they're doing. He's driving for that which produces value. That's in the vision space. He's connected to the value creation work that God put into the heart of him. He's what God worked in, God is working out of him. They're the number one gas detection manufacturer on the planet today, and they're accelerating faster than their closest competitor. They're getting harder and harder to catch. Kent went on when he stepped down as CEO of Industrial Scientific to become the chairman of the National Safety Council. And if you are bothered by the fact that the rules are getting tighter on texting while driving, you can blame him for that because it's one of his causes. Interesting sidebar. Work or home, what's the most dangerous place for you. I have the statistics from Kent. Concerned about safety, work or home, which is more dangerous for you? Home is. Okay, at home, which room is the most dangerous room for you? Kitchen, bedroom. Bathroom. The answer is bathroom. In the bathroom, what's the most dangerous place for you?
Shower.
Why? Slip. Do you know what the most pound for pound effective investment you can make around safety? Those stupid little sticky things on the bottom of your shower. I just threw that in at no extra charge. Vision, mission, values. Each of these are distinctive ways that you bring value to the world. God plants into you passions that He wants to work out of you. It's God doing the planting. We do the working out. We do the fleshing out, the year over year, paying attention, getting our eye off the scoreboard. By the way, at the end of the game, the score is important data. If you go to Industrial Scientific, Kent's son, Justin, who's the CEO now, will say, I do not want my people thinking about extracting economic profit from this business. Here's a quote from Justin McElhattan, son of Kent McElhattan, now the leader of the number one gas detection manufacturing company in the world. When I was in business school, I had a professor who said, the purpose of business is to go into an economic sector and extract profit from that economic sector. And when you can no longer extract profit from that economic sector, to go to another sector and extract product. This is all a quote. Having grown up in Industrial Scientific under the tutelage of my father, that was the most distasteful thing I ever heard in business school. We have the privilege of putting ourselves at the service of men and women who work in dangerous workplaces. And if we do a good job of putting ourselves in their service, we get to stay in business another day. His eye is not on the scoreboard. His eye is on the value creation. Now, does he not pay attention to his P&L? Of course he does. Does he not look at margins? Of course he does. Does he not bring every discipline known to a great, smart, hard-driving business person? Of course he does. But as soon as he takes his eye off of value creation and puts his eye into trying to figure out how to get the numbers to work differently, the game is over. It's just going to take a while to know that. We're on earth to produce value. Value is bringing ourselves to the service of things that value what we do. There is no barrier between serving and profiting when we have a whole understanding of how God has designed the rules of the universe. And so we have freedom to become bold and non-anxious about this, to go for broke, to live into and to live out of all of the things that God has put into us. T.S. Wong, I shared a little bit about him 3 years ago, founded a toy manufacturing company in the Guangdong province of China, in Guangzhou. And when he founded Jetta Corporation 38, 39 years ago, he told his wife, I'm going to run this business according to the teachings of Jesus. I apologize to you. We're going to be poor. Because he believed that the way you make profit is by going after money. And he was going to go after some other stuff. So he thought it through. Missionally, I gave you an example from Industrial Scientific. Visionally, Kent McElhattan had a vision. Missionally, T.S. Wong had a distinctive way of bringing value, and he made a commitment to people. He read his scriptures. He made a commitment to integrity. He read his scriptures, and he made a commitment to not poison the earth. The earth is the Lord's. He read his scriptures. And then he went after that. And it became clear to Mr. Wong at a certain point in his business development that fundamentally he was in the business of growing people. He became clear about his mission. Toy maker, no. People builder. Hospital, no. Scheduler. Pizza maker, no. Deliverer. He became clear that he was a people maker. What he saw was that young people from all over the provinces of China would flood into his manufacturing facilities for the sake of 3, 4, 5, or 6 years of working on the assembly lines in order to accumulate some capital so they could go back to their home provinces and buy a small business or buy a small home or start their family. This was a capital accumulation strategy for 40, 50, 60,000 young people at a time. They weren't coming to Jeddah to have a career in extruding little tiny plastic objects on vast conveyor belts. They were there because they had a chance to accumulate capital. And realizing this, he understood, at a crack, I'll have 40 to 60,000 Chinese young people for 4 to 6 years. What will I give back to China as a product of my investment in them? How can I change China by building a new Chinese citizen who understands integrity, the rule of law, honesty, doing things the right way, keeping your word? What kind of a citizen can I give back to China if I make sure that they finish their education while they work for me? And so he put all his effort on his mission that God had put inside of his heart to grow people. And year after year, that focus on mission differentiated him from Chinese toy makers. That focus on mission stood him apart. He wasn't peering over the cubicle at the Chinese toy-making competitors in order to try to do it that way, to borrow the advantage of that particular thing that was done that he hadn't done. He stuck to mission. And year after year, he got better and better and better and better workers, because it became clearer and clearer across the labor pool that you wanted to work for Mr. Wong. And he got more and more and more buy-in and engagement. And customers began to notice that the people who did work at Jeddah did it the right way. And then the toy industry blew up because half of his competitors had created junk, and that hit the news. And that, as it does, you see, in God's universe where he wrote the laws and wrote the rules, that contributed to his growth. Tell you one more piece of Mr. Wong's story. A couple of years ago, now I want you to remember that I want you to put away anxiety and go after that which God gave you to go after. I just don't want you to forget. That's why I'm telling these stories. A couple of years ago, this man who told his wife 38 years ago, "I apologize, we're going to be poor. God's given me a mission. I'm going to follow it. We're not going to make money, but I'm doing it." The premier of China ordered the CEO of one of the top corporations in China, which was having too many suicides in their Chinese manufacturing plants, to go down to Jeddah Corporation in Guangzhou and spend time under the tutelage of Mr. Wong, to see if this CEO could learn how to run a company where people don't want to kill themselves. Did God have that in mind when he placed Mr. Wong where he placed him? Did Mr. Wong know it was going to end up that way? Golly, I want to be fruitful. What could I do to one day have the premier of China send CEOs to me to learn how to be better leaders? That isn't how it worked. The fruitfulness of that man was not his creation. The bigness of his contribution to the world was not a product of his muscle. He didn't strain to pop out that apple. He rooted himself right into the soil that God had given him. And he worked out his mission faithfully, kept his eye on the ball, kept his eye on the field, went through the behaviors every day. It's like the salesperson. I don't know how many salespeople are in the room, but you know what will kill a salesperson is thinking that every time you knock on a door or pick up the phone or drive in a farm lane, there has to be a cash register sound at the end of that lane. You got to keep your eye on the behavior if you're a salesperson. Otherwise, you become depressed. Otherwise, you crawl in a hole. You ask yourself, what are the things I'm going to do today because they are the right things to do? Well, I'm going to pick up that phone 20 times. Here are the behaviors I'm going to do. These are the things I'm going to do. Will any of them generate a sale? I don't know, but I'm going to say, yay, God, at the end of the day when I do the things I said I was going to do. My eye is not on the cash register. It's on the behavior. Every great salesperson I know knows the behavior they need to follow, and they let the fruit come behind. Our Lord is the vine dresser. He brings the fruit. Your calling is to stand up into that distinctive way that you were made, and then that distinctive way that you caused an organization to gather around you so that you can occupy that place that God had in mind for you. I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands how many people know whether what I'm about to say is true. Raise the hand inside your own soul, or don't inside your own soul. This is a private assessment. The Lord had in mind before the beginning of time that enterprise you showed us on this PowerPoint last night. He had that in mind from the beginning. Do you know that that is true? It's true. And I want you to rest in it. I want you to rest in it. We have this treasure in jars of clay, Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4:7, so that this all-surpassing power can be understood to be from him rather than from you. Why did Paul say that if I'm not telling you the truth right now? Paul was just talking about the amazing glory of Christ in the advancement of his kingdom in relationship to the shoddiness of you and me. You know, we are fractured and broken and cracked and sin-ridden and fearful and frail and go on and on and on. Talks amongst yourself. We have problems. We aren't that hot. And God works up in and through our lives the fruit that he wants to bear. And our job is to rest in him and get up every day and work like crazy in the joy of the Lord in what he's given us to do. I'm going to stop there for tonight and see what you want to talk about. We have a little time now set aside. I wish I had a stool. Comments, questions? Thoughts, objections, complaints? Not the complaints. I don't want them.
So if profit, I'm hearing and understanding and liking what you're saying about not putting your eye on profit. So where does the balance come into how much profit is?
There comes a stool.
And,
How do you balance this thing of enough? When is it? When is a certain amount of profit appropriate? I don't know when a certain amount of profit is appropriate and inappropriate. I do think the idea of maximizing profit is grotesque. It's like the guy going to the gym to maximize muscle. Muscle has a purpose. It's very important. You better have muscle if you want to get something done. I don't want to hang out with the person who has maximized muscle. I don't. That puts muscle as the only thing important. So maximization of profit is grotesque. Now, if we can just set that aside, it's grotesque because it makes a means an end. Whenever we make a means an end, we've got an idol, and we're no longer serving the Almighty Lord. So I'm not interested in maximizing profits, but on the other hand, fantastic profits can be fantastic. So if you can live with those two things I just said, if you create a value proposition in which people are growing and customers are being served and value is increasing and the world is getting better and the profiting that comes into your company is very strong, I want to say congratulations. Praise the Lord. Imagine now, being the business leader you are, what new things you can do as an instrument of God to think about deploying your resources in the advancement of the kingdom. But if you just heard me suggest that if you make a lot of money, you can give it to Rosedale to really make it holy, you didn't hear me. Give it to Rosedale. But that doesn't sanctify the profit. Profit is sanctified because what you did was profitable. I want to give you an example on this. Our thinking is cracked. I went to Industrial Scientific when I was the head of a $6 million nonprofit organization, Pittsburgh Leadership Foundation, sat down with my friend Kent McElhattan. Kent is a dear friend. His wife Martha goes on a walk with my wife every week. We hang out. I love him. He's my buddy. He's running a close to billion-dollar company, growing rapidly. He loves the Lord. I'm running a Christian nonprofit organization. I want a gift. I've lived on both sides of the four. I've been a nonprofit executive, a business owner, and a pastor. So I was being a nonprofit executive, and I wanted to sanctify some of his profits. And I gave him an investment opportunity to die for. I hit him right between the eyes of his heart. That doesn't make sense. It's been a long day. And Kent said, well, John, I want you to listen to this. We've been looking at the Industrial Scientific Foundation. They pour a lot of money into the Industrial Scientific Foundation. We've been looking at the Industrial Scientific Foundation and what we should do with its money. And if it was an open book to us, we want to do it, we want to dole it out across the city, and, we can be written up in the United Way campaign, and we can be listed in the back of the program book for leadership. I mean, a lot of people would see what we're doing with our money, and we'd seem like good corporate citizens. If that's what we wanted to do, man, for you of all people, I'd make the first gift. But we've made a decision that since our vision is to eradicate death on the job, every charitable dollar we give out of the Industrial Scientific Foundation is going to be invested in untested, leading-edge, innovative, high-risk efforts to find new ways to save lives. I'm really sorry, John, but your request is not our priority. He didn't need to have his prophets sanctified because they were already sacred. And the discipline of his thinking in that I find stunning. He knew that those prophets were already pleasing to the Lord, and he wasn't buying off a penance with me. I don't like, I'll be candid with you. May I just be a little extra honest for a few minutes? I don't like socially responsible investing. I don't like triple bottom line. Because across America, these campaigns are driven by people who believe that business is evil and they ought to pay back. And so we're not going to hammer you for the grubby business that you're doing if you will participate in our socially responsible investing campaign, in which case we'll call you a good guy. Here's what I suggest. Run a business that's good for the world. Period. Serve the Lord in the for-profit sector with the fullness of heart. And when it's a giving moment for you, give generously, because that's also a blessing, not to balance your scorecard. How do you feel about that? Swing for the fences as a business leader for the kingdom. And then when you have, in whatever situation you're in, large profits, think about the kingdom investment pool, which, by the way, you will also be accountable to at the end of the days, and how much more value add that can create by reinvesting that. Reinvest it in the private sector or the social. It's fine. They both belong to God. Let's not be dualistic about this. Build another business, crying all day. Did you hear that, John? Crying all day, Andrew. I got two friends back there who know that I say that too much. It's my favorite saying. My second favorite saying is for crying all night. Oh, dear. Did I answer your question? You know, sometimes we're in a business that's really, really important, and the profit margins are always going to be slim, but it matters because we're bringing value, and it's never going to be a fat profit margin. Do that to the glory of God. And sometimes we move out into the market with something so distinctive that for a season there can be very strong profit margins. If all is moral and holy and sacred and joyous, then receive them, for crying all day. Receive them. It's the fruit that the Lord bestows upon you. Just understand, to whom much is given, much is required. And be very charitable. Don't get me wrong. Go to Rosedale first. Be very charitable. But be an investor. I want us to think more holistically. I want us to understand life whole. Another question, thought, comment. We could talk about a taste of Holmes County. Isn't that what's next? What are you thinking? What does it look like to abide? That is what I'm talking about in the morning. So I don't know how to start that conversation without having to come up with something brand new to say tomorrow. I would just say, because this will bear repeating, that if Jesus himself, if Jesus the Christ, if God incarnate needed to abide, then we better. We better. The man I work with, I sold my company, Serving Ventures, to a friend and colleague named Rick Newton, who owns a company called Newton Consulting, and I went along with the sale to be president of the Newton Institute and direct the Center for Serving Leadership to work at this Serving Leadership agenda with a larger resource pool so that we can propagate the work that I do beyond my direct capacity to do that work, trying to be a steward of this work by getting it past me. And this man I sold the company to is completely sold out to the leadership of God in his life. And so one of the things he's done, and you could say, well, this is gimmicky. It isn't in his case. He refuses to take the title of CEO. He's the president. He is a natural strategist, and when he started his company, through deep prayer, it became clear to Rick that he should not muscle this company into existence by being strategic. He should be spiritually responsive to where God wanted him to go. That was his answer to the question. That isn't necessarily yours. In part for Rick, that was important because he would say this if he was here. If he is prone to an idol, it would be the idol of I can get there because of how strategic I am. So God was dealing with something in his life and asking him to rest in him. If your idol is I don't have to do anything and I can coast, God might want you to plan real hard and then go after it. So we can't tell each other what the answer to that question is in specifics, but it certainly means going deeper in our understanding, understanding that God is God and God is in charge, and B, in our spiritual discipline of listening and watching and paying attention to what God is doing. When you're walking around, two words I use again and again in my leadership work, in my coaching, is intentionality and attentiveness. And it's really important, in part, on your question of abiding, that we're paying attention. I know a lot of leaders who are in the room with you and their head is full of their plans and they've got the metrics over here and they've got the designs and they know what they're going to say and their brain is all wired and they're charging and everyone with them is outside of their sight. They're not paying attention. They're not with the people they're with. They certainly, these leaders, are not listening even to their own heart or to the Lord who made them. And so somehow, I mean, this is, you asked maybe one of the most important questions that we ask the rest of our life, how do I walk and chew gum at the same time? How do I drive to a goal and wait on the Lord at the same time? You'll spend the rest of your life on this. Drive to the goal and wait on the Lord. Swing for the fences and let it in God's hands. I think this is why people like golf so much. Because when you stand over that ball, it's going to be an awful shot if you don't simultaneously focus entirely and forget. You golfers know what I mean? You have to be absolutely focused and you have to let go simultaneously. I think this is why golf is so powerful in people's souls, because it touches a deep mystery. When Jesus got up in the morning, he had a plan for his day. He had a plan. He set his face toward Jerusalem. He said, we're going over there. He had a plan, and he executed his plan. I'm in favor of planning, thinking it through, making our lists, doing the very best we can, standing up straight and tall, and then going for it. But he missed nothing along the way. So the littlest thing happened along the side, he noticed it. So he wasn't so devoted to his plan, got my plan, that he couldn't see what was going on right beside him. And so the tug on the coat or the sound of a child or a man in a tree, he noticed it. Now, I know people who are one or the other, very attentive, very there, very with you, or very not with you. I mean, they're going. In our growing up, we're called to be both. Jesus understood. He said, I'm working and my Father is working. So do that. And so when he moved, he was working. And when something happened, he understood that his Father was working. One of my friends in Pittsburgh calls this being an aggressive responder. An aggressive responder to what God does right in front of us. So, I don't know if that was helpful at all, but that's the answer. And how old are you?
38.
I give you 60-odd years to work on this. This is going to become extremely clear to you within a few seconds of your death. That I promise you. Larry.
I think I can ask this question now because I sold out last year. Servant leadership, you were talking about prophets.
Yeah.
There's a lot of business people here that are probably asking this question but would not have the nerve to ask it. If I implement servant leadership in my organization, what can I expect bottom line? Is it profitable for me to adopt Jesus' way of doing business or leading?
The question is, if I implement servant leadership, will it be profitable for me? If I do it Jesus' way, what can I expect on my bottom line? Did I repeat that roughly as you asked it? It's 7:42, and we're having a treat at 8. I will answer that question if I may have the final 17 minutes of our time to do so. But if we have 3 or 4 more questions, I can't really respond to that. What do you think? Okay. It's a very important question. And I'm glad you asked it, Larry, because I like answering it. I actually steered away from this question because I talk about this all the time, and those of you who have been in my groups with me have heard me talk about this, and I'm conscious of not wanting to say things to people in the room who've heard me say those things before. When Jesus' disciples came to him wanting greatness, I've referenced this text. Their mom came. Jesus answered the question, said, you shouldn't ask for greatness. You'll suffer. Well, you'll suffer anyway. Plus, it's not mine to give. That's what Jesus said. The father hands out the promotions. I don't. You're asking the wrong dude. And then he goes into a teaching session and he says, if you want to be great, serve. If you want to be first, put yourself last. If you want to be great, if you want to be first. If you want to be great, if you want to be first. Larry's question, what if I want profits? It's roughly the same question. And I'm not going to take us deeply down this path, but I've asked many people to ponder whether Jesus was scolding them for wanting to be great. It would be roughly likenable to asking the question, is Jesus scolding us for wanting to be profitable? And my answer, we're not going to play with it, my answer, right or wrong, is he was not. They asked for greatness. He said, you want that? Serve. You want to be first? Make yourself servant. In the same way, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's not a scolding. It's a teaching. You want greatness? Let me make it plainer. You want that? Do this. It wasn't, you want greatness. Huh, you shouldn't want greatness. You should want to be walked on. You want profit, you should desire bankruptcy. It isn't a scolding for the aspiration. It's a teaching for how to get there. Larry's question was, if people are asking, what about this serving leader business? Will it be profitable? It's akin to what the disciples are asking. Eventually, the disciples figured out what Jesus was about. They hadn't. At the end of this little scene, they didn't know what was going on. They still wanted Jesus to become king like David, ride a white horse, kick the Romans out. That's what they wanted. That wasn't what Jesus was doing. Jesus wasn't doing that. He was doing something much more profound and powerful to transform the world. They didn't get it. Eventually, they got it. And after his death and resurrection and ascension, and as they grew, they came to understand his teaching to make themselves servants. And then along comes the Apostle Paul, who understood it profoundly. And so the disciples went out into the world and they practiced the teaching of Jesus to serve. They essentially said, I'm going to go for that serving leader stuff. Okay, now, so now's the question. How'd it turn out for them? We're still talking about them. That's one answer. Any others? Larry's going like this. In the short term, not so good. So, 10 of them got executed. That wasn't fun. Probably in 2015, unfortunately, we have a more vivid understanding of what those executions were like than maybe we've ever had, watching the world as it is today. One of them abandoned. One of them got adiosed to Patmos. And so, in a certain sense, there was great hardship. But Paul said, we're still talking about them. They wanted greatness. And so my comment about this is that, Andrew's phone is dead, but I just discovered this. I've been working right in front of a clock all weekend. You guys have been laughing at me. I know you have. There's a clock right behind him. He's looking for a clock. Why doesn't he turn around? Not to look back. Don't look back. Straight ahead. Practicing what I preach. They wanted greatness. And so what I have to say about this, first of all, is that it's imperative that you understand leading like Jesus, leading as a server. Leading, let me help you understand what a server does. A server, a servant, a serving leader knows that it's not about them. It's about the people who work for them. It's about the customer they serve. It's about integrity. It's about purpose. It's about mission. It's about value. It isn't for them. They're a serving leader. And the thing they're serving is not themselves. They go to work every day asking, how can I bring value to the world? How can I serve the kingdom? How can I bring out to the world things that customers need? How can I put others first? That's what a servant leader is. The leader who says, how can I make this really cool for me, is not a servant leader. And if you lead this way, the results that are guaranteed are greatness. That's what Jesus said. This is different than a success formula. A success formula says, do A, B, C, and D, and you always win. Jesus says, place yourself in the service of something greater than yourself. Understand who you are in light of who I am, and I will cause your life to be awesome and count forever. It's a greatness formula. It's not a success formula. We have to be clear about that. You can lead this way and lose a deal. You can lead this way and lose your job. You can lead this way and lose your company. You can lead this way and lose your life. It's not a success formula. It's a greatness formula. You with me? We should not have any evidence that these disciples ever existed. If we took fine mesh sifting equipment to the Middle East and went through all the sand, we shouldn't find a fragment of evidence that they existed. And they are instrumental through Jesus Christ in the transformation of the entire planet. How do you like them apples? They wanted greatness. Did they get greatness? So here's the evidence from the marketplace. When I find companies that are outperforming, all the way back to Jim Collins, they're outperforming, they're out-earning, they're out-innovating, they have the best talent, they keep the best talent, they keep their talent longer, they can afford to invest in their people get better, their customers are wowed. When I find companies like that, I find serving leaders at the helm. That's what I find. Leaders who aren't there to serve themselves, but leaders who are there to serve something that matters more than themselves. Did I just say that those leaders didn't have some incredible hard knocks? Of course I didn't. So my encouragement to you is keep your eye on the master. That's my encouragement. The evidence is that the companies who buffet their way through all the hardships, fall down and get back up and get better, bring more and more value, grow in reputation, keep their eye on the ball, don't get distracted by fame, become amazing, and profit, bottom line, Larry, have disproportionately almost to the point of ridiculousness, serving leaders at the helm. Not soft leaders, serving leaders. What grows our people, what serves our customer, what keeps our word, what holds our standard? These are tough leaders, these serving leaders, who are about something that matters more to them. By the way, these kinds of leaders do fire people because of the importance in certain circumstances of firing people in order to have the organization be a serving organization. This isn't soft leadership I'm talking about. This is we need to get the job done because it's not about us, leadership. So it's a funny way to say it, but my money's on the serving leader. And the evidence around the world is that if you want your money to keep growing, put it with a leader that's trustworthy and that isn't thinking about themselves. A quick example of this, Paul O'Neill. Is that right, by the way? Perfect. I don't have to worry about that. Somebody should hit a gong. What was that hook? Somebody should get a hook. Take me off the stage. Paul O'Neill, one of the great serving leaders, took over Alcoa. Alcoa was somewhere in the $6 to $8 billion range when he took it over. When he left Alcoa to become the Secretary of the Treasury for the George W. Bush administration, they were in the $35 billion range. Paul O'Neill brought a heart of service and an ethic of high values. Humble man, strong man, don't mess with what's right in front of Paul O'Neill. And he said, we're going to be about the safety of our people. Very reminiscent of Kent McElhattan. We're going to be about the safety of our people. The human life matters. And we're going to be about their safety. He didn't say we're going to be about our profits. He said we're going to be about our safety. He gave an instruction in the finance office of Alcoa. If he caught anybody calculating the money saved or the money earned by their commitment to safety, he would fire them because he didn't like that way of thinking. Hey, makes money to save people. Because as soon as we think that way, then we're thinking about making money instead of safety. And the next time it doesn't make money to have safety, we might make the other calculation. He said, if I catch you calculating how much more profitable we are because of our safety records, I'll fire you. Paul O'Neill's a bit of a firebrand himself. He sent a message across his worldwide company of 140,000 workers that his number one goal was the well-being of his workers, and he made it mandatory that the immediate manager in any situation worldwide where there was an injury, however small, had 24 hours to contact him personally, and he provided his personal line or the manager was fired. The safety infraction, the injury, was not a fireable matter. He wasn't trying to drive injuries into the closet. So you had an injury, understood. You call me in 24 hours so we can talk it over and learn how to have it not happen again. You don't call me. I am going to learn about it. You'll be fired. He put incentivization on reporting. And he drove lost work days at Alcoa down to an almost infinitely small number. He cut lost work days from injury by about 80% and drove profits from the billions to the tens of billions. All the way back to where we started. What causes organizations to be great? Human beings who show up in droves bringing more. That's what does it. What do 140,000 workers who say, do you know what the new CEO is doing? Put some rules in place that our manager's got to call him personally if one of us gets hurt. What does the bauxite miner in Brazil think that the CEO is thinking? Well, that bauxite miner thinks the CEO is thinking of me. It was a brilliant message, disciplined in its execution, to say, I am here as CEO not to make my stockholders happy, sorry people, but to drive safety. Publicly traded company. He made his stockholders very happy, by the way, as he invested in serving and wrapped his organization around it. This wasn't window dressing for Paul O'Neill. He cared about it very deeply. When he stepped down, Klaus Kleinman stepped in. Klaus Kleinman had been under ethics investigations at Siemens, where he had been CEO, and that thing had been settled behind closed doors. Nobody knows what Mr. Kleinman actually did at Siemens, but he did something, and he settled it, and, you know, they knocked elbows, I suppose, and they agreed to whatever it was, and whatever he paid, it never got reported, and he came over to Alcoa because he was a hotshot. He was a hotshot, guy who knew how to make money. I said my money's on the serving leader. Klaus Kleinman got to Pittsburgh, took over Alcoa, and his first announcement was not, safety is my number one goal. I want to make sure workers all over the world are protected. I'm the CEO and I care about them. His first announcement was, we're moving corporate headquarters to New York City. And my wife doesn't think the shopping's good enough in Pittsburgh. What do 140,000 workers think when the new CEO rides into the corporate office and makes that the first act? 140,000 workers think, boss isn't thinking about me. What is the aggregation of 140,000 human beings, treasures everyone, who make marginal additional effort, who feel more dignified and more valued, who feel like someone's thinking about them? What is the aggregation of 140,000 human beings showing up at work saying, you know, we ought to do that because that isn't quite right. Let's not cut corners. I got an idea. If we did this, it would save us some money. Putting their shoulder to the common wheel. What does 140,000 workers times whatever that extra is that a human being has in infinite dimension do for the profitability of a company? If the CEO thinks, I'm the smart guy who knows how to make more money for my company, and those people are just people I have in place to do the jobs I want them to do, that CEO has an impoverished imagination. The serving leader comes in and says, I've got treasure. I'm going to put myself to the service to them, like the farmer who plants a seed in the spring because there will be a crop in the fall. That's how a serving leader works. You have to do this by faith. You know, this isn't machinery. Throw the lever. Look, serving leader. I'm a serving leader. Throw the lever. Now the machine does the new thing. This is more like agriculture. We're building culture. You plant the seeds. There's going to be a crop. We need to know this is how the kingdom works. Long answer, but the evidence is that if you want to lose your shirt and a fortune, hire a bunch of self-centered jerks. And they'll get a lot of front page brouhaha about how smart they are. And the stockholders will think, hey, we got the good one. But track them. If you want to lose your shirts, buy someone whose eyeballs are focused on their own pocket. Don't you think? May I say a prayer for us? Would that be legal? Thanks, Lord, for being kind to us and for thinking of us and for making us. And we know that we're a product. We're the product of your value add. You had an idea, and it seemed good to you to put your hands to the wheel, put your fingers in the dirt, and to build us, to shape us, and to place in us potential, and to serve us. Forgive us for our weak faith. You're a master of the universe, and you've declared, it rings out through the ages, that you are servant. And yet we're not quite sure whether we can afford to be one. Thank you that you wrote the rules, that the governing principles, the architecture and the engineering of all of reality obeys you. Everywhere we look, we see your rules at work. And when we look into the marketplace and into the business sector, when we watch how men and women bring value into the world, exercise vision, discipline, focus, create and make stuff, serve things, fix things, bring themselves to bear, flourishment happens, and your shalom expands. All of this is you. And I pray now as we call today a day, have a little fun before the day's over, that we may...